Our fourth case for argument this morning goes by the illuminating title of Appley versus KJ. Mr. Hall, good morning.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. We're here on an appeal today of a denial of qualified immunity because two detectives face the prospect of being found to violate the Constitution for one of the detectives having a less than 1 minute discussion with a maximum security inmate outside of that inmate's cell door.
I'd like to go back to Chief Judge Sykes's observation that this is a weird caption. What is the basis for your clients proceeding anonymously?
We have no desire to proceed anonymously as respondents. My understanding is that that was compelled in order to protect the identity of the appellee.
I don't see how revealing the identity of a couple of public employees would reveal anybody else's identity.
I agree with
Do
you
you?
completely, Your Honor.
And it's bizarre. We see cases like this all the time where the state employees proceed in their own names. So you agree there's no basis for your clients to be anonymous.
I agree with that completely, and
All
we
right.
proceeded that way in the lower court.
Okay, thank you.
The detectives were following up on a tip related to an attempted homicide case that was about to go to trial. And in response to correspondence received by the appellee, and it's going to be awkward to continue to use that, the detectives really made three efforts to attempt to gain more information from the appellee. It started with a phone call, but that wasn't good enough for the appellee. From there, detectives came to the prison in an effort to meet with the appellee away from his cell in a conference room. The conference room did have a window, but it was nowhere near the individual who was subject to the criminal prosecution cell. And when all of that failed, the detective made a determination to take one last shot, to take one last effort to see whether or not this inmate was truly willing to cooperate and provide information. And so he went to the inmate's cell door, knocked on the door, and in the course of about 40 seconds, identified himself as a sheriff's detective from Columbia County, indicated that he was here to talk about a letter that they received, did not divulge the details of the letter, didn't divulge a specific case, didn't divulge the names of any inmates. When the appellee refused to engage, the detective simply said, "This is your last chance. This is the final time I'm here to talk about this." And that was the end of it. We now have these detectives potentially facing Eighth Amendment liability, despite the fact that while the appellee maintains that that communication was sufficient enough to out him as a snitch, there was no assault. There was no inmate-on-inmate violence. The only claim in this case is purely psychological harm. Now, it's important to recall we're here on a qualified immunity appeal. In order to defeat a motion for summary judgment based on qualified immunity, the contours of the constitutional right need to be clearly established within the circuit.
Is there a clear trend going this way of the law with regard to that particular right?
The Eighth Amendment,
Right.
right, and the harm. I don't think you can identify a trend in any direction. What we can identify is that the published decisions from this court, going from Babcock to Doe, even to Glover, really do stand for the proposition that when we evaluate the case under the Eighth Amendment, there needs to be some physical harm. It's the assault itself. It's the failure to prevent a reasonably preventable assault that violates the Constitution. It's not the threat of assault or the risk of assault. And that point is driven home in Babcock, in Doe, and other circuits have taken notice. The Eighth Circuit, the Tenth Circuit, admittedly, have issued decisions that would seem to be contrary to those rulings. And those courts have noted that. But within the Seventh Circuit, the published decisions from this court have put detectives like my clients on notice that in the absence of an actual assault, there is no viable Eighth Amendment claim. I think what's happening in some of this court's unpublished decisions is there's a blending of the PLRA nominal damages for in the event that there isn't a physical harm with the Eighth Amendment's consideration of, is there significant harm? So under the Eighth Amendment, given the Supreme Court's decision in Farmer, the courts are instructed to review whether or not there's a significant risk of serious harm. And this court has concluded that when we look at that serious harm component, that in the absence of there being some physical harm, and if we're talking about a conditions of confinement case, so not a use of force case under the Eighth Amendment, then in that event, there needs to be physical harm. That's been the rulings of this court from Babcock and Doe. That is separate and distinct from a damages consideration under the PLRA. Under the PLRA, of course, if there is no physical harm, damages are limited to only nominal damages. And so when courts, you know, and even this court, when this court has evaluated this issue in unpublished decisions, and I'm speaking specifically to certainly the Turner versus Pollard case, this issue of the application of the serious harm under the Eighth Amendment wasn't even on the table. It wasn't discussed by the court. I don't know that it was even considered by the parties. It was purely just, well, the PLRA applies to this, so therefore nominal damages are all out. Our argument has been, we don't even get to that without the serious harm, without the actual inmate on inmate attack. This is not a cognizable Eighth Amendment claim.
What if we end up not going down the prong two route of qualified immunity and go down the prong one? Does that present a problem with regard to either the disputed issue material fact or MS's role?
I think the ultimate question, if the court were to go down the first prong, is going to be the role of that phone call that occurred after the visit. Okay. And for purposes of appeal, for purposes of summary judgment, we accepted the appellee's resuscitation of what occurred during that call. And that call, according to the appellee, was effectively the other detective who was not there, accepting responsibility, more or less apologizing for having the detective go to his cell door. What that does not do, though, is that does not establish any malicious intent to cause the inmate harm. What it may establish is that, again, giving the appellee every benefit, as we're required to do, maybe this was a consorted effort to contact the appellee in a way that could send a message to the potential or to the criminal defendant, hey, you should take a plea here because the evidence is starting to mount up against you. That is different than the cases that we've seen in the Eighth Circuit and the Tenth Circuit, where those involve corrections officers who are physically in the prisons, who have some sort of clear animus towards the inmate saying, I want to cause you harm. That is different than saying, you know, even if it's a ill-founded plan, that is not consistent with what occurred in that phone call. That phone call, if we give the plaintiff, or I'm sorry, if we give the appellee credit for his version, essentially just establishes that this was a scheme or a plan to try to get the criminal defendant to take a plea, not to cause him harm. With that, I would like to reserve my balance for rebuttal. Thank you.
That's fine. Thank you. Ms. LaRosa. You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Jory LaRosa, and I, along with my colleagues, represent the appellee. The key question for this court is whether appellant's qualified immunity argument focuses exclusively on legal questions about immunity or whether it depends on factual disputes tied up with the merits of this case.
Ms. LaRosa, let me begin by asking the same question I have to Mr. Hall. This is a very unusual caption. I've never seen the like before. I'd like to ask you, why is your client entitled to proceed anonymously? even as John Doe, as opposed to a place name like Appalee.
Sure, Your Honor. We do not want anyone to be able to piece together the identity of our client. He is a confidential informant. This court has recognized.
I understand that, but your client's claim is that the defendants behaved in a way that revealed that information to the prison populace. What would be the basis, if the other prisoners already know that he's an informant, for keeping the public in the dark?
If other prisoners do not already know, if there are any that do not already know, and this would might be able to confirm his identity, given the level of factual detail, there's information in the record about where their cells were placed, and given that level of detail, it could harm or cause other inmates to piece together the identity of our client.
So you think the worry is that not all the inmates knew?
That could be the case.
Is there any problem with labeling the plaintiff John Doe?
No.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Does it make any difference that he's the plaintiff here? He's the claimant, as opposed to being involuntarily in court?
Yeah.
In terms of his claim for to proceed with a pseudonym, whether it's Appalee or John Doe or any other pseudonym initials.
The pseudonym is not... It could be John Doe or Appalee.
No, I understand that, but the fact that he's the claimant here, he's not involuntarily in court as a confidential informant would be in a criminal case, for example.
Does that make any difference?
Right. He has invoked the legal process here to claim money damages.
Sure.
So why wouldn't he
I think
proceed as any other civil plaintiff does in the open?
Sure. I understand Your Honor's point. I'm not sure that Appellee versus John Doe makes much of a difference. But in terms of protection, I recognize that it could also be John Doe.
I'm not talking about what name we use. I'm talking about the substance of the request to proceed anonymously.
The substance of the request, whether that
yes,
might
whether
cause
the,
additional harm.
No, whether it makes a difference here. A confidential informant gets... protection because he or she is involuntarily hailed into court to support prosecution typically. Here he's the claimant. He has voluntarily invoked the judicial process to seek money damages from these officers. So why shouldn't he be subject to the same rules that everybody else is subject to, regardless of whether you know, he prefers to remain anonymous to protect himself.
Well, I'm not sure that we have an issue with whether he would be named as John Doe like any.
No, I'm talking about using his actual name.
Right.
As he did
his
in the district court.
Name. I'm sorry.
We have a lot of precedent in the Seventh Circuit saying that adults who bring litigation expose their names to the public, even if they strongly prefer to keep it secret. Why shouldn't we apply our norm? That's the question.
Indeed.
Chief Judge Sykes is asking.
Thank you for clarifying, Your Honor. My response to that would be that using his name, as I mentioned previously, although he may have been exposed as a confidential informant to other inmates within the cell block or the area where he was exposed, there may be other inmates within that institution or other institutions that recognize his name, that expose him to a risk of harm if his name is used in this case. And so using Appellee or John Doe protects him.
The question, at least my version of it, starts from a very strong presumption in the Seventh Circuit that if you are a plaintiff and an adult, then your name is public. I haven't yet heard a reason why confidentiality should be allowed.
The reason why confidentiality should be allowed is because branding an inmate as a snitch can expose him to a substantial...
Yeah, it turns out that a lot of people who bring lawsuits are talking about discreditable behavior that exposes them to harm. Imagine somebody who brings a Title VII suit and says, I was wrongly fired from my job on the ground of my race. And the defendant says, no, the reason you were fired is that you were incompetent and you stole from the company's supplies, right? A lot of discrediting information comes out that will leave the plaintiff harmed, but we require him to be public. That's why I'm asking, you say here's a potential harm, therefore private. But that's true in an awful lot of cases.
And I take your point, Your Honor. In this case, again, it goes back to the revealing his identity in combination with the other factual details in the record could expose him as a snitch to additional inmates outside of those in his cell block. And that is our basis for the additional protection requested here. Your Honors, I do want to address some of the points that my friend on the other side made. And
okay. I have one concrete question.
Yes.
Does any case in the Supreme Court or the Seventh Circuit say that prison guards or detectives or the like can be liable when they expose the prisoner to a risk, but the risk does not come to pass?
Your Honor, I would turn this court to this court's decision in Babcock, where this court said that an intentional—
This is a district court decision?
That this was.
Yeah, can you— My question was the Supreme Court or the Seventh Circuit? Clearly established law, certainly the Supreme Court. Maybe the courts of appeals, although the Supreme Court has left that question open. But district courts do not clearly establish the law.
Your Honor, Babcock, I'm sorry, is a Seventh Circuit decision. I'm referring to Babcock versus White. This is the decision that the district court looked to in order to determine the harm that led to an Eighth Amendment violation here. The district court, based on the facts at summary judgment, credited appellee's assertion of psychological harm. Appellee asserted that after the visit to his cell door, inmates began to extort, intimidate, and harass him. And the district court credited that assertion and found that appellant's conduct were malicious because they intended to out appellee as a snitch to LA, the very person whom appellants hoped appellee would sell out. And this court looked to the Babcock decision, which in that case, this court distinguished claims in which a prisoner alleged a mere failure to prevent exposure to risk of harm, which does not state an Eighth Amendment claim, from those claims in which a prisoner alleges that an officer intentionally inflicts psychological harm, which can state an Eighth Amendment claim. And I would direct this court to the fact in the district court record that the district court credited, which is that phone call after the visit to appellee's cell, in which appellants admitted to outing him and admitted to doing that intentionally and then apologized for those actions. My friend on the other side tends to ignore that fact in their argument today and also in their briefing, and that is a key fact both for the both prongs of the qualified immunity analysis.
Does that apply to each of your clients, though? Does it apply equally to KJ and MS? Because we're dealing with intentionality here. There's a certain state of mind requirement before there can be this type of constitutional claim. And for that to occur, does it separate for each of your clients?
Your Honor, while KJ was the appellant who went to the cell door, when MS made the phone call, he apologized and said that it was both of their plan to out him. That is on page 5 of the record. And again, that is a key fact that goes to both prongs of the qualified immunity analysis. On page 5 of the record, you can see, Your Honors, appellee asserts that MS apologized and explained that he decided the best way was to let LA know he would be convicted at trial was to out appellee as their snitch. This is a key fact for both prongs of the qualified immunity analysis, and I would ask that this court note that fact when looking at both prongs if it decides it has jurisdiction in this case. See, I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Mr. Hall.
I'd like to begin just with commenting on the discussion of the Babcock decision. At page 272, this court explicitly held, we nevertheless believe it is the reasonably preventable assault itself, rather than any fear of assault, that gives rise to a compensable claim under the Eighth Amendment. That is the published precedent of this court. The Doe versus Wellborn decision, which came a year later, was likely even more on point. That case involved a inmate who started a fire in his cell in order to alert guards that there was about to be a hit on the warden. Later after that, a correction officer goes up to that inmate and says, effectively, I realize you're the one that started the fire, but you don't get any special privileges, and said it in front of everybody so that everybody knew that this inmate was the quote unquote snitch. Even there, this court concluded that because there was not actual violence, there was not an actual assault, there was no Eighth Amendment claim. Extreme deprivations are required to make out a conditions of confinement claim. And finally, the final point I want to direct the court to that I haven't had a chance to address is the follow-up letter that was sent by the inmate, by the appellee, even after the visit on December 6th. After that visit, about 10 days later, the appellee sent the sheriff another letter, and in that letter was once again offering to help and wanting to offer to help. And in that letter, he, in very bold print, says, he still trusts me. He still trusts me, suggesting I can still get information for you. And if that's 10 days after the visit to the cell, I would submit to the court that this case really is baseless. And with that, we would request that the court reverse. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much. Our thanks to all counsel and Ms. LaRosa, Ms. Mark, Mr. Camelli, seated in the second row. Your firm accepted this appointment pro bono on behalf of your client and the court. You have our thanks. And we'll take one more recess. This case is taken under advisement. We'll take one more recess to substitute another group of students.